So I'm going to basically extend the topic that we talked a lot about last week down to much smaller scales. And throughout this talk, I'm going to try and convince you why feedback from low mass stars is interesting and important. So first, I'll try to motivate it, why you should pay attention, and then I divided the talk into two parts, the first on protostellar outflows, and the second on line-driven winds, so winds from more massive evolved stars. So first, because we spent so much time last week at a very large scales at high redshift, I want to orient everyone. So we're going to zoom down into the area that I'm actually talking about. So if I say filaments in this talk, I'll be talking about, you know, filaments inside molecular clouds. So I talk about clusters, it's not galaxy clusters. Okay, so we're going to zoom in. And the mode of star formation that I'm going to talk about today is one of very local star formation, familiar star formation from within the Milky Way. So going down to even the smallest scales, the scales I'm going to talk about today are kind of parsec to AU type scales, maybe 10 parsecs at the outset. And of course, the main thing to keep in mind is when I say low mass stars, here's a nice fiducial low mass star that we all want to care about and keep in mind. And it's this particular type of star that's really interesting and important in terms of understanding the feedback in this context. So the other thing I want to remind you of is that not all star formation happens in massive star forming regions. So if you look at molecular cloud distributions or cluster distributions, the number goes as 1 over m squared, okay? So that means equal mass per log bin. So a lot of star formation is taking place in smaller clouds. You know, it doesn't all happen in these massive complexes.
Well, let's test the clusters, I guess, put the mass function in shallow.
It's slightly shallower and actually varies as a function of radius in the galaxy. So I guess when look close to us is about minus 1.5. In the outer galaxy, it's minus 2 again. So yes, it is slightly shallower, but you still have that dependence. So the key question in this talk is, what is the impact of stellar feedback on star formations and on molecular clouds? So unlike last week, I'm not trying to get feedback to destroy the cloud or impact the galaxy. I'm just trying to look at the subtle effects of how this feedback influences the molecular cloud and the star formation that happens within it. So obviously there's two ways to tackle this question, and both of them have their flaws. So on the observational side, this is a very complex nonlinear problem. So it's best to keep in mind the parable of the blind astronomers and the elephant, where here we have a bunch of observers looking at different observational metrics and then trying to form a coherent picture with what is happening. And it's a very confusing picture at times. Now, on the other side, there's also problems with theory, because we get very excited about our simulations. We have to bear in mind that sometimes we need a reality check. So the best way to really investigate this problem is through synthetic observations, where we try to take the simulations into the observational domain and hence interpret them and also learn from our mistakes. So the beginning of this picture, the beginning of the story, starts with turbulence. So all molecular clouds are turbulent. Here's a beautiful image of the Taurus molecular cloud. And this is, oops, sorry. I think I'm being recorded. All right, so my mic is very turbulent, apparently. Okay, so this is velocity structure in the cloud. We have red and blue shifted velocities. The green is intermediate. And so you can see there's this huge, very complicated filamentary structure going on. If you look at the line widths are very broad. So you have this very complex turbulent motion that's happening within star-forming regions. And this basically crosses a very large range of scales. So if we put this, the spectral line width versus cloud size, we get the line width size relation going over many orders of magnitude. Now, this is also known as Larson's law, but since I've been at Yale, I've learned that Richard Larson does not like that, and so this is known as Larson's relation. So if we look at this, we can learn a couple of things. One, that these clouds are very turbulent, and that the star formation is in some way deeply shaped by this turbulence around it. And two, this is partially responsible for the inefficiency of star formation. So we have to understand what's going on here. Now, the question is, where does all this turbulence come from? And this is really an open question. There are a couple of different models that suggest this turbulence might actually come from the stars themselves. Once you have stars forming, they inject energy into their environments, and perhaps we can get some of this turbulence from, for example, bipolar outflows or wind-driven turbulence. So this is the type of feedback that will sustain the turbulence, reinvigorate the energy in the cloud, but not destroy it. So the tool that I'm going to use to model these is an adaptive mesh refinement code. Yes, so I'm going to be talking about them specifically in a minute. I guess I'll be getting into that. So the tool that I'm going to use to study this is the adaptive mesh refinement code Orion. And I decided not to put up all the equations on here, so we saw some of them last week. But basically, we include turbulence, gravity, FLD, so radiative feedback from the forming stars, ideal MHD, star particles to represent these protostars and their evolution, and then I'll talk about the outflow and wind models. So basically, in the first half of the talk, it'll be radiative feedback, and the second half of the talk will be mainly ideal MHD. All right, so protostellar outflows. So here are some beautiful images of protostellar outflows interacting with their environment. This is NGC 1333, a cluster of maybe 150 protostars, and the outflows there are basically being shown in this brownish-greenish emission. But when you look at images like this, it's very hard to see these collimated bipolar outflows are not doing something to their environment. If you look at individual outflows, you can see that they also potentially have an important impact on their local surroundings. So basically, they either interact with their parent core and have a local feedback effect, or they interact on larger scales, up to a few parsecs, and they actually interact globally and potentially inject turbulence. All right, so another thing to bear in mind is that these outflows not only inject energy, but potentially affect the efficiency of the star formation process. So if we look at the distribution of dense cores before they form stars, they look suspiciously like the shape of the IMF, only shifted by a factor of 3. So it's been proposed that maybe outflows entrain and remove gas and can account for some fraction of this efficiency factor. The question is, how much? And this is somewhat of a debated mapping, but potentially it could be very important, and outflows could play a role in this efficiency factor. All right, so now specifically protostellar outflows and how we go about modeling them. So last week we heard a lot about subgrid models for feedback at galaxy scales. Now, I'd like to tell you that when we go to small scales, we can dispense with all the subgrid models, but unfortunately, that's not the case. So these protostellar outflows are basically launched by the twisting of these magnetic field lines where the gas and magnetic field are strongly coupled. This gas is coming in, it's flung out along the field lines in this very collimated jet. Now, unfortunately, the highest velocities and the strongest collimation happen very close to the protostar. We're talking at stellar radii. So here's a beautiful self-consistent calculation by Kengo Tomita. And this calculation took a year, both in terms of the physical time that was evolved in the simulation and the amount of time it took to run the calculation. So to get down to stellar radii and launch these things self-consistently is completely prohibitive if you want to do that on a cluster scale. Yeah, that's terrible. So, whenever I see Kengo, I pester him to do parameter studies, which is not very nice of me. But I really need his model to help inform what I'm doing for my subgrid model. Yes?
Stella, where did these fields come from? Are these in the cloud itself?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
Is are not coming from the star.
No, but I mean, that's how the star gets some of its field through this accretion.
There is some interaction between the stellar field and the inner part of the disk. So it's debated if it's the relative distance of that versus the field that is carried in the accretion field.
Mm-hmm. Is that thought to hold the time out stars as well? Do they go through a similar T-Torre-like stage?
I think it's argued again. There are some models that are very self-similar in terms of, you know, high-mass stars being a scaled-up version of low-mass stars, but there are also different models in which, you know, everything's a lot more extreme. You have more ionization, for example, higher accretion rates. Okay, so what I want to do is try to have a subgrid model that follows the essence of what's happening in the actual simulations. So basically, what we do is the outflow mass loss is some fraction of the incoming accretion rate, where that fraction is around 0.1 to 0.3. So this sort of follows these semi-analytic models that are developed for disk winds or X winds. And then the velocity of the launch gas is related to the Keplerian velocity at the stellar surface. So we follow the accretion rate hydrodynamically, and we follow the stellar parameters by following a kind of model for stellar evolution based on these 1D Pella and Stoller models. So the one missing fraction is what is the collimation factor. Again, this is taken from a semi-analytic theory, which goes and matches observations. So presumably, this might evolve with time or varies from model to model. But you know, until these calculations run for more than a year, we can't really say anything in great detail about the typical collimations on small scales. So this is basically what such a model gives you. If you zoom into small scales, you get a hydrodynamically created accretion disk around the protostar. You're launching the winds, and this creates a cavity. Here, this is just showing you the gas temperature in the cavity. But basically, you can see a nice collimated structure surrounded by this hydrodynamic accretion disk.
So what part of this is resolved and what isn't? That's what you're following the... So you're resolving the disk, but you're putting the wind in by hand? How does that work?
Yes. So this is 4AU resolution. So and it's hydrodynamic. So there's no magnetic fields in this. Yes, I'm getting to magnetic fields after I talk about the hydrodynamics without magnetic fields. Yeah, so certainly for hydrodynamics, the subgrid model is absolutely essential in putting in the outflows.
But how do you actually, in practice, do this? How do you apply, you know, do you put it in the star position? Where do you put it?
Yes, so there's a group of cells, plus or minus 8 cells, around the star.
Okay.
And then we basically compute using this model, the momentum and mass deposited in each cell. So you basically evolve, determine the accretion rate of the star, and then this is actually injected right outside the accretion zone, so you're not messing with the accretion flow.
Your star is a sink particle.
It is a sink particle, yes, that is correct. The sink particles also emit radiation, so they are actually heating the gas around them. So I'm first going to talk about a simple, isolated star-forming core and how the outflows affect the evolution of a single star, and then I'll talk a little bit about star clusters. So you're going to see a movie of column density for three different views, this is basically starts with uniform initial conditions. We inject some turbulence and then allow it to collapse. So it's a fairly simple setup. Once the protostar forms here, you can see that it's launching this outflow, which breaks out of the core fairly quickly. And over the course of about 500,000 years, the outflow entrains quite a lot of gas and basically pulverizes the initial core. So you can see that there's a lot of high velocity gas, but it's also a lot of structure that's created in the surrounding gas.
Is this thing only forms one?
It depends on the setup, yes. So this basically forms one, but it, you know, it could form a binary depending upon your initial conditions.
So how large amplitude was the turbulence?
let's see, so about 0.5 kilometers per second, so a few times the sound speed, approximately following Larson's relation on this size scale. So in this nice isolated environment, it makes it easy to see where the gas goes. So how much of the mass ends up on the star, how much is launched, and how much is actually unbound and ejected. So when you do that, you can actually see that there's a kind of main accretion phase here. And if you define this as stage zero, when the stellar mass is less than the envelope mass, you find a main accretion stage length of about 100,000 years.
And what's your accretion law? What's your accretion?
It's basically self-consistent. Whatever the gas is coming in, it accretes.
But you said you have a sink particle, so it's resonates within a certain radius?
Yes. So the accretion zone is about four cells around the center. This is based upon Mark Krumholtz's prescription. So it, you know, it has it does have a mapping to the von Mises solution. So that if you don't resolve the region, then it goes to the correct solution. But here, it's basically the mass that's coming in is accreted onto the star.
So you don't have alpha, so the accretion is basically through gravitational instabilities?
Yes.
And so what are you doing about the temperature?
What am I doing about the temperature? We solve for the temperature using FLB here. So we assume the gas and dust are coupled. The outflow is actually launched. We assume the gas there is ionized, so there's no dust in the outflow. And then there's line cooling, actually, that determines that gas temperature. But otherwise, the dust and gas are determined, you know, through this solution of this equation with a source term for the star. Does that answer your question?
But before the star turns on, are there problems with it fragmenting?
Not really. There is a little bit of fragmentation, but it only happens kind of at the very beginning when you have this kind of unstable thing that's collapsing.
Right.
But the fragments are pretty small and they merge. Like, I don't think they're physical. Mm-hmm. So if you go to higher resolution, fragmentation goes down. And, you know, at no point in this particular calculation do you get, you know, something that I believe is a, you know, resolved secondary fragmentation.
And maybe just a quick comment on the accretion recipe. So it's basically when you when you don't resolve the ginsengs anymore sufficiently, then you just cut off the density that is too high because it will violate the gene's criteria. So you make a sink in Mark Krumholtz's implementation, he makes a sink, so he makes tiny sinks and then merges them with the bigger sink in the center. So that's how stuff accretes. The von Mises accretion is a limit that is, I think, for this kind of thing, not relevant.
Yeah, that's right. But for this simulation where there is radiative heating, there is very little of this small kind of fragmentation early on. And basically, it goes away if you go to higher resolution. So I don't really believe any of it. All right.
So then when the accretion is basically mediated by gravitational instabilities in the heated disk.
Yes, there is numerical viscosity, though, in the sense that, you know, you just have artificial viscosity on the grid, so it's not like there's no viscosity.
Well, I guess it depends on how the resolution is compared to the disk.
That's right, yeah. All right. Okay, so you can look. So I varied a couple of the parameters in the simulations, for example, the fraction of gas emitted by the outflow and the opening angle of the outflow to see how that would affect it. And you can basically, from these, construct a star formation efficiency, which turns out to be how much gas actually made it onto the star versus was ejected completely from the calculation. We get values that are about 40%. It doesn't seem particularly sensitive to these other parameters. So that suggests that if you believe this mapping between the core mass function to the IMF, a significant fraction of this actually can come from protostellar outflows. All right, so I promised that I was going to talk about kinematic feedback. So now we can basically look and see what this momentum and energy injection is doing to the surrounding gas. So this movie is going to show the velocity evolution of the same outflow, and it's colored by tens of kilometers as a red, a few kilometers per second is in blue, and then smaller than that is in gray. So this is the initial core. And you can see it forms a star here in the center. And then there's a single fragment there, which formed that other outflow. But then we get the single outflow at, you know, evolving over time for the rest of the calculation. So what you can see is that you can see the outflow very strongly, this nice V shape here. And over time, you see this blue gas developing around it, which is higher velocity kind of interacting and entrained material, which is somewhat interacting with this outflow. One other thing you can notice, the outflow is somewhat variable. There's asymmetries on the top and the bottom, which depend upon basically the distribution of gas. And you can see that there's asymmetries also, which depend in part that the accretion is not completely smooth. All right. So basically what happens is the velocity initially decays, but you get it increases slightly because you have the gravitational collapse. You get this protostar. And as soon as the outflow develops, you get quite a lot of momentum and energy being ejected into the surrounding gas. And it limits to about 1 kilometer per second, about twice the initial value. So one other thing you can do, which Christoph has done a lot of, is to try to characterize the turbulence and separate it into solenoidal or non-solenoidal components. So I actually shamelessly stole this from Christoph. You stole it from Adam Ginsberg. Yeah, Adam was like, no, that was mine. Anyway, so the... Okay, so I mixed it up a little bit when I put it in. But the non-solenoidal is the compressive part of, compressive part of the turbulence, and the solenoidal is kind of the mixing or stirring part. One other thing that when you give this presentation again, I've noticed that people stop paying attention to you if you leave up the clapping monkey. So it's very important to stop the clapping monkey so people pay attention. Yes. Yeah. Okay. So when you go ahead and do this separation, the turbulence that I put in is initially solenoidal. The modes kind of equalize. When you get gravity beginning to compress the core and take over, you get more compressive motions. The solenoidal part decays a bit. Then you have the formation of the protostar, and then there's a lot of activity. And it goes to about 1:1. And this 1:1 is a little bit, it's strange, actually, why it's kind of self-regulating like that. And in this particular case, I think it's because it's an isolated protostellar outflow. So you always have gas coming in, and you have outflow going out. And through our model, the accretion is coupled to the outflow. So if you start driving more turbulence, the accretion rate goes down, and then that kind of feeds back. So if you do this, let's see. So there's a star. So if you do this instead with not an isolated outflow, but for a cluster of outflows where every single protostar in the cluster is driving an outflow, you get a very different result. So here there's no central collapse. There's no very strong gravitational component that's driving a large-scale compressive mode. So here you end up with much more solenoidal turbulence. And the solenoidal component does actually go up once the protostars start vigorously driving outflows.
Can you quickly say where you measure, I mean, how do you measure that? That's coming out of the piece around the stars, or are you taking the average of the whole
small box?
And how are you weighting in? Are you weighting in by volume or by density?
I have to look at specifically what I did. Probably weighted by volume, but I have to check.
Because the corresponding to lowest order observational weight is always weighted by density.
Yeah, that's true. So I know that Christoph has been doing this and working with Adam Ginsberg on actual observational data. So maybe when he gives a talk, he will talk more about that.
How can we constrain that observation, just in a very broad sense? Do we have a sense of that?
It's very difficult because you only have information about the velocity of the line of sight. Right. But Chris Bunt has an idea now how to reconstruct the fraction of compressive modes. So, like, that's going to be published soon. basically, it's based on our spectrum, also the calculations.
Yeah, so the problem with this this approach is basically this is entirely living in theory land, and so you would like to do this comparative work to actually find a statistic that's meaningful to be used with observation as well. So in order to expand on the synthetic observations, I've been working with a student to actually make synthetic observations of these outflows and assess how well observers can reconstruct quantities like the mass and the outflow, the momentum, and the energy. And so to do this, we basically start with a simulation. We compute the emitted emission, say, in 13 CO. You have to assume some abundance for CO. And then run this through CASA for different configurations. So this is generated assuming a full ALMA configuration with a beam size of a few arc seconds. So if you would you could actually look at this thing at about 500 parsecs away, you know, this is what you would see with ALMA. So it's a, you know, it's a non-LTE setup. We assume a dispersion of maybe 0.2 kilometers per second for thermal line width, which is part of the unresolved turbulence. Maybe it's 0.1, something appropriate to the size of the pixels here. The temperatures are taken directly from the simulation, and that means that in the case where the temperatures are high, the CO abundance is set to zero. Am I missing something? Yeah, so yes, okay, so when you do this, you can construct a synthetic observation. And then we know in the simulations what the total mass is compared to what would be inferred from the CO emission. So he computed this, and the lines you want to compare are green and blue, and the light blue and red. So these are two inclinations of the outflow. And what you see is that these lines are actually extremely close together. The Z one is blue. This is along, maybe the outflow is tilted maybe 20 degrees with respect to the line of sight, and this is maybe 40 or 45 degrees with respect to the line of sight. So this is computing the actual mass along the line of sight for a view versus what you would get from that view from the emission. So the 13 CO is actually optically thin, and we find that the optical thin approximation works pretty well. And in all cases, we're summing up the mass above a kilometer per second. So
this is not a real observation, but it's synthetic observation and then trying to reconstruct from what you see.
That's right. So basically the question is, how well will ALMA do when it's mapping these regions and determining what the mass, momentum, and energy are? Yeah. So the answer is, you know, obviously full ALMA is better than, say, compact. And we find that 13 CO is better than 12 CO. But I mean, this is actually really good news because we paid a lot for ALMA, and we'd like it to actually be able to recover these sorts of properties well. So this suggests that it will.
It looks better just because it's optically thin.
Yeah, so we also did this with 12 CO. 12 CO is optically thick in 1 to 0. And we find that as long as we use the 13 CO to estimate the optical depth, we can actually correct the 12 CO enough that it becomes comparable. But you absolutely need the 13 CO. Otherwise, the 12 CO is completely useless.
Would 12 CO, in practice, would that ever be useful?
Well, I should say that Hector got almost cycle zero time to look at HH4647, which is very similar to this. And he only had 12 CO. And so he had to make mass, momentum, and other estimates using that. And this basically shows that he should not have done that.
But if you don't have 13 CO, optical depths, then you can't do it. But if you have 13 CO, you have your answer already.
Yeah, I think Hector still liked the 12 CO better. I guess if you have more extended region, I mean, maybe you pick up a little bit more of the gas. I think if I showed you the two plots with 12 and 13 CO, you can see there is a little bit more structure in the 12 CO, but it doesn't seem to be hugely significant. I don't know. I think the moral is you need as many tracers as possible. All right. So what I'm currently doing is rerunning all of these calculations with an initially uniform magnetic field, and then assessing how well these previous results, or how the previous subgrid model did. And what you can see, this actually doesn't have radiation feedback in it, and so you do actually get some secondary fragmentation. I'm not sure that I believe that, so I still need to do the study with radiation included, but that's currently what I'm working on. All right, so now we're going to switch gears and talk about line-driven winds. So these are no longer these magnetically launched and collimated winds. These are line-driven winds from O and B type stars. So I first became interested in this when I went to the CFA, where Alyssa Goodman and collaborators and Hector Arce had been taking this data of a Perseus cloud and actually looking very carefully at its structure. So some of the things that popped out were evidence of outflows, which are these high extreme velocities here. This is actually a position velocity cube. So when you see extents in this way, it's velocity. And the other directions are x and y. So what they noticed by doing these kind of volume rendering images of the cloud were that you could see some unexpected holes or shells within the cloud. There's one right there. And so they thought it was really interesting if they, you know, they found these features that hadn't previously been identified, and then they tried to go ahead and map how much mass momentum and energy was actually in these features. And so when they did that, here are the ones they identified, they found that the totals for these was much larger than had previously been identified in protostellar outflows. So what this suggested was, if you want to drive turbulence within clouds, you might have these winds, which could be responsible for injecting a significant amount of energy. So it's not clear what all of the sources of these shells are, but several of them do appear to be associated with more evolved B stars. So these stars either formed in the cloud in a previous generation of star formation, or they wandered into the cloud because they were local. So this issue came back to me as a problem when we were working on a separate project trying to assess how well the structure in molecular clouds could be characterized, for example, the virial parameter and mass and dispersion. So in this project, we took an Orion simulation that was meant to represent Perseus. Then we went through this process of constructing a synthetic observation. And we tried to compare simulations that matched the mean column density and mean velocity dispersion. So the distribution of H2 column densities and distribution of RMS velocities in 12CO are actually not bad. So I thought they were pretty good, but Alyssa looked at this and said, what is that? So there's this excess of high velocities, this excess of momentum, which seems to be associated with the shell features in the data. And it's significant enough that it's making a big impact on the overall distribution. So the question is this simulation an example of a pink elephant? So to address this problem, I've been doing additional simulations where now I put in the winds and see if I can reproduce the structure and see if they actually are making the same impact on the cloud that's observed in Perseus. So Nathan Smith gave a talk last week. He had this nice plot showing the mass loss as a function of stellar luminosity and for different phases of massive stars. The regime that I'm working in is down here. So I'm going to be using the Vink et al. Models. But he did point out this issue of the weak wind problem, that when you get to low masses, the amount of mass loss that can be driven in lines drops quite a bit.
So how does the Vink et al. Differ from that? So what is the, are there any observations here, or what are the different models there?
Yeah, so the Vink et al. That I'm using is 2001. So what they did is they calculated their model, and they do have observational data. So the data have fairly big error bars, but you know, the model seems to agree reasonably well with the data. The weak wind model seems to be more recent. So a couple of groups have gone back, including Vink, and have redone the calculations, and they find that there is a problem as you go to these, you know, lower masses, lower temperatures, and basically their new calculations kind of die out here because they can't launch the winds. So I'm not entirely sure where this line came from. Probably one of these follow-up studies, which is a mix of attempts at modeling this and data.
That's like nearly two orders of magnitude different if you're down at D4.
That's right. That's why I was very upset last week.
Okay.
So the weird thing here is that...
I think this is an observation. Like,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But the weird thing is, so when I started these calculations, I was also not just using this, but I was using the inferred mass loss rates that Hector had in his paper. So if we look at the parameter space, which I'm going to show in a minute, Hector's estimated mass loss rates are here, 10 to the minus 6 to maybe 10 to the minus 7. So that's all the way up here. So I haven't quite figured out what is going on and what is the discrepancy between his estimated mass loss rates and these more evolved stars. So that's something hopefully I can figure out with these simulations. Okay, so the way this model is implemented, it's another feature of the sync particle algorithm, because we know the mass, we're following the stellar radius, the stellar luminosity in the models, and then as a function of that, we can launch a wind, which is isotropic in the cells around the star, according to this prescription from Vink et al. So there's also a distribution of velocities. Unfortunately, if I want the calculations to run in a timely manner, I have to cap it at about 200 kilometers per second. Otherwise, it gets kind of annoying. So what I did is I took one of these simulation domains, and I randomly scattered these B star particles in it and drew randomly for different mass distributions. So in black is Hector's inferred mass loss rates. You can see they're actually quite high here. The peak is at 10 to the minus 6 solar masses per year. And then these are my random populations of stars. So I'm not actually sure I gained anything by doing it randomly. I could have just drawn from his distribution. But at least I have several different ones to compare. So here's one of these calculations. It's meant to be a piece of Perseus. It's about 5 parsecs on a side. And so this is about comparable mass loss per volume as would be suggested by Hector's estimates. So what you can see is that the winds expand fairly rapidly. In this case, they remain fairly spherical. And if we were looking at this in column density space, we would see shells here. And if they evolve for long enough, then we'd expect these shells to actually break out of the cloud. I'm using the Vink et al. Models, but if I'm randomly doing it, I need to draw from a set of stellar masses. Or I need to somehow determine, you know, some statistical model for putting in these stars. So if I... No. So the issue is we don't know what the masses are. So we only have the mass loss rates. So in effect, the thing that's important about these models are really the distribution of mass loss rates. So in this case, I randomly picked masses from a range of masses that I thought would give Hector's distribution of mass loss rates.
But those are way up. I mean, if you look at the Vink et al. Compared to what you said his typical was, that would put you up in the O-star.
That is entirely correct.
Okay.
And so this is what happened. Yes. Well, one of them might actually be close, but yes, they're not O stars.
I guess it's like you're not really using Dink at all. You're just saying you're using his
MDOT. So.
Yes. Yes.
Right.
So basically, what is the range of masses that you choose? What is the range of masses from which you draw from? Okay, so I was drawing from a set of masses that would give me something close to what Hector had. And that is, well, now that I understand that the Vink et al. Model is very, you know, is a lot higher, you know, that's slightly different than what Hector has. So I was drawing masses, from that you get accretion, a distribution of accretion rates.
Okay.
Really what's important is this distribution of mass loss rates, not the actual masses of the stars. So the masses of the stars are not well known. Hector's values for the mass loss rates are inconsistent with the Vink et al. Models, but this is something I'm trying to sort out. So if I have a number of realizations with different mass loss rates, I can say, you know, okay, you know, these objects in Perseus, you know, must be in this range of masses, or there's something inconsistent between Hector's model and the.
For the mass loss rate that he infers.
Yes.
Do you actually get structures like he sees from?
Yes. So I'm in the beginning of doing that, and for this example, the answer is yes. So for these set of mass loss rates, it's comparable to what Hector inferred per volume for Perseus, and you get structures that look very similar to those in Perseus. If you do this and choose from the Vink et al. Model and don't do it wisely, then as you point out, the winds are too strong. So you get a much higher fraction of the volume in these winds. So for this particular simulation, they would basically be breaking out of the cloud fairly early. But one of the things I'm trying to do with these models is understand their impact on the turbulence. So for that part of the problem, it doesn't matter what Hector found. We just want to understand how these might shape turbulence in the structure in the cloud. So if we go to the raw turbulence statistics, the density PDFs, and energy power spectrum, you get typical log normals with no winds, the kind of typical range of power spectrum without winds. You put in the winds, and you see some changes, but actually not as much as I was expecting. So when you put in the winds, you are basically evacuating a lot of the areas in the bubbles, which gives you a distribution of very low gas densities. So this gives you this extra feature here in the PDF. Now, unfortunately, that's only theoretically interesting because that's not something you'd be able to observe. And there seems to be a very minimal effect on the high part of the PDF, which would be much more observable. It was initially imposed, and then when the winds are on, there's no other driving. So the winds are just supplying the energy. So for the power spectrum, I was hoping to see some kind of feature associated with the scale in which the winds are launched. But basically, I see nothing. The slopes might be different by about 0.1, but there's no, you know, maybe there's a little bit of extra energy up here, but there's nothing significant that would allow you to discriminate between a wind-driving source and, you know, a larger scale source. So that's kind of interesting and annoying. That's true. Yeah, they are growing.
It's probably a late time.
That's right.
Which case is the case where the shells really don't expand that much?
That's purple and black.
So even though it's quite confined, the power, even going down to k equals zero, is increased.
That is what I find. This is the energy power spectrum, not the velocity power spectrum. What was I going to say? So even in the case where they don't expand that much, the bubbles are reaching at least a parsec size scale. So it is some fraction of the box. I can try to, you know, plot this as a function of time and see what happens. But yeah, I didn't see anything particularly characteristic.
You have the issue that if you have like two or three expanding bubbles in the box, you mm-hmm. create an isotropic kind of velocity field. Mm-hmm. So what is the exact meaning of this power spectrum in this case, right? So you are very sharp on the release, the velocity field is in the bubble, so if mm-hmm. you take a Fourier transform of that, you will populate all the Fourier modes. And
yeah.
So it, I mean, you're not really in a pure, clean, isotropic kind of turbulence setup. Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't populate at a wavelength which is larger than the structure.
That's true.
is your structure, basically your last structure here is caves, basically. How do you normalize caves?
I haven't, this is the total, I haven't renormalized this. So it's the total energy.
What basically, physical scale does a log k of 1 correspond to?
It should correspond to the whole box.
Okay, 0 is?
0 should be the whole box.
But you don't have, you bubbles, are you bubbles actually breaking out to the whole box?
In this blue case, they are. In the purple case, they're not.
But you still see it.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, this is why I'm giving an informal talk, because I'm trying to understand how to study these things correctly. So that is what I was looking for. That is exactly what I was trying to find, and that is what I do not see. So, yes. Okay, so you do what you do see.
Maybe it does depend on the time, because if you're no in this case, it's a later time, then the total power would have been less than at the earlier time.
Yes, I think so.
So were they in the same time or a different time?
Slightly different times.
I mean, that might.
Yeah.
Because if the no-wind space, the whole power spectrum is.
That's right. So there is a slight difference in slope, but it's not. So something is going on that's slightly different, but it doesn't seem to be statistically significant to me.
Anyway, you could just take a piece of your cloud that doesn't
have
a shell in it and look at that.
And look at that. Okay.
And short shells will actually populate power on scales larger
than
them. Because they have a mean, right? So they contribute even to the K0 scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, these also have fields, so.
It depends on. But then it's no longer periodic, so then you have to make copies of your box in order to then take the power spectrum. That's true if you have many, you have to pad your box for zeros to actually see them.
Okay. All right, so you do actually see something different when you look at the velocity distribution in synthetic observation space. So trying to recover something that looks like this, you can go through the same procedure, basically synthetically observe it in 12CO, and then compute the same velocity distribution. So here's with no winds, and then here's with winds. So though it's not really affecting the velocity power spectrum, except apparently in the normalization, you do see this this tail that's going out to much higher velocities. So at least this looks like the observations, even if we don't understand the turbulence statistics behind it. So turbulence statistics are something that's very interesting to me. So I want to take the last few minutes to discuss this project that I collaborated on recently with Eric Rosolowski and a bona fide statistician, Jason Lipke. So the idea is, if you have a turbulent cloud or a turbulent box, what is a good statistic for you to apply to that box that is quantitatively and physically meaningful? Okay, so what statistics should you apply to determine if parameters are changing or are varying in a physically meaningful way? So we used what is a subfield of statistics called experimental design to basically make a parameter study. And in this parameter study of simulations, we vary the Mach number, driving scale, B field, and temperature. So in this case, we used ENSO simulations, which are MHD self-gravitating simulations, but it's also an AMR code, so it's very similar to Orion. So when we did this parameter study, we then translated all the boxes into observational space. So constructed a synthetic 13CO data cubes. So here are slices through the cubes. This is the same seed. This is a higher Mach number, and this is a stronger field. So visually, you see fairly large differences in these synthetic observations. So we applied a couple of common statistics to these different data cubes to see which of them could pick out changes in these physical parameters. So we used principal component analysis, spectral correlation function, and the Kramer statistic. So the goal of these statistics is basically to encapsulate the difference between the cubes in one characteristic value. So when you do that, you can then estimate the response of the statistic to a change in the parameter. So for example, if we change the Mach number, you hope that the statistic is sensitive and picks it up. If we do this, you know, a different turbulence seed and don't vary any of the parameters, you don't want the statistic to pick it up.
Can you say what number you're getting from this? I mean, the spectral correlation function or PCA have many numbers associated.
That's right.
So what is the one number?
So this is the distance metric here. So if you have two spectral correlation functions for two different data cubes, the distance metric is purely the sum of the differences
of
the coefficients. Yeah. And here it's the eigenvalues. The Kramer statistic is already a kind of 2D statistics which looks at the differences between points in two data sets. So it just produces one number. All right, so we found something very interesting, which is that the statistics are all very sensitive to the Mach number.
But hang on, just one second. That is the difference between one model and another model, but it looks like those are labeled by a single model.
Yes, so the way the parameter study is designed, it's kind of a two-parameter test. So we have low B field and high B field. Can the statistic tell the difference between a low B field model and a high B field model? Likewise for Mach number, driving scale, and temperature. So the surprising thing here is this is Mach number, magnetic field is B, K is driving scale, T is temperature. These ones that have two, are both of them are changed from the parameter, the fiducial parameter. So here Mach number and magnetic field are changed. So basically these are obtained by solving a matrix of these different distances, and so the negative value is okay. So you have to solve for the, you know. That's right. That's right. So the distances themselves are positive, but we need something to tell us about the significance of the distances. So we're solving for another coefficient, which gives you the response. So the absolute value of the differences does not matter so much as, you know, the overall study and how they all change. So I think that's what it's telling you here with these negative values. I have a backup slide on that, but I don't think we have time for that. Okay, so changes in Mach number are strongly significant, which is, here's the significant line. But changes in magnetic field or driving scale are virtually not detected at all, which is very strange. And the disappointing thing is also that the magnetic field itself had virtually no sensitivity to this. So this type of parameter study is telling us something very interesting about these statistical tests that we're trying to apply to the data. So in this very controlled way, we can try to pick out statistics that are sensitive to a particular physical parameter. So
way of modifying differences. That would be sensitive to changes in the driving scale.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes. One of the secondary things that this paper does is create a robust statistical parameter study. And often people, when they do these tests, do one factor at a time. One of the morals of this is you can confuse yourself by thinking that a statistic is sensitive to something when you just change one parameter. So that was part of the message of this particular paper. So to believe that, I would also want to go back and test it on this particular set of simulations, which we're currently doing a follow-up paper doing more statistics. Yes?
Can you remind us, like, what are the statistics used by traditional turbulence, you know, analyses that are typical in the turbulence literature setting?
I don't know. People look at higher order moments, power spectrum, PDFs, but those are not observationally so helpful. So these are the ones that are kind of used more by the observational community who are trying to characterize cloud structure. Blakeslee-Burkhardt also has a set of additional metrics, and we're also including some of those.
In just the turbulence literature, people look at structure function. They look at basically the velocity differences between points as the distance varies. That's what everyone likes.
Yeah. But you're, it's not particularly useful for you here.
Not in observational data, where we only have one line of sight. And we're trying, and we basically have a density bias where we can only look at a range of densities. All right, so this about concludes my time. So I'm just going to leave up my conclusions, and then hopefully you'll stay tuned in 6 months or a year when I finish these MHD calculations and we have an improved statistical analysis that can be applied to winds and determining their effect on clouds. All right, thank you. Yes.
Just to jump on the MHD calculations. So I remember that Thomas Bell and Nakamura did some outflow calculations.
That's right.
So can you outline the differences between what you did and what you did? And what do you expect from the MHD? And do you expect to reduce the efficiency of and why?
So several people have done clusters with outflows. The Nakamura, Lee, Wang, Abel calculations are similar. They were done in ENSO. Their model was a lot simpler. They have just one kind of set collimation. And they basically, in some sense, they fiddled with their initial conditions until they got the IMF, because Tom doesn't like seeing particles and doesn't believe them anyway. So their outflow model is slightly different than this outflow model. Otherwise, it's fairly similar. Adam Frank has also been doing a lot of these turbulent boxes with outflows. And again, he has an also another simplified model for outflows.
So what is the expected effect of magnetic fields when you...
It usually reduces the star formation efficiency, say by factors of two or more.
So it means you will go down to 20%.
I should speak more carefully. It reduces the overall star formation efficiency in the cluster by factors of two. So that's that basically is adding extra support, pressure support to the whole cloud. So it reduces star formation. So when you include calculations of, you know, of the magnetic fields with these winds on small scales, no one has looked at that yet, and tried to say how magnetic fields change the efficiency on these small scales. And that's what I'm doing with these calculations. And that's what Christoph is doing with some of his calculations. So.
Because I remember the argument was that if you don't have any fields, the outflow will kind of pinch out the box and a lot of energy will be lost. But with magnetic field, they are kind of forced to work against the field lines, and a lot of energy is kept inside the box and they're probably used more efficiently.
Yeah, so it's also more efficient at driving turbulence. So there are several ways it can affect efficiency, both through reducing star formation, but also if you drive, you keep more energy or drive turbulence more efficiently. And though I find that even without the magnetic fields, turbulence seems to be injected very efficiently.
And do you have an idea of how much of your energy is actually leaving the box?
I have not calculated that. I was mostly focused on how much mass was leaving, but you could calculate that.
That's probably, I mean, if you have a strong enough magnetic field, that's probably the main difference. You're going to find the energy to the star forming region.
That's what I'll find out.
So I'm sorry I couldn't get here earlier, but, and I don't know when you're stirring up turbulent motions, it's part of your talk. I remember some work by Robert Banerjee, Klessen, and I think some students in Heidelberg looked at this many years ago. Didn't find much power transfer.
Yes.
Can you discuss that?
I didn't discuss that work, but the reason that they did not find much is because they injected it into a very smooth medium that had no turbulence in it. So it was very hard for the jet to couple with the cloud, and it just broke through. But as soon as you put in turbulence, and I think Roby finds this now with his new simulations, that you can actually drive turbulence very effectively.
So entrainment is pretty important. I was wondering if your entrainment processes are well resolved.
Yeah, so I did actually test that. So how does the efficiency change as you increase the resolution? And it seemed like it was pretty well resolved. So we increased by a factor of 4 and found very qualitatively similar results. But yeah, you would expect some effect. You know, if you really coarsely resolve it, then you think it would be less efficient. So what parameter? Oh. So for the magnetic field cases, I'm using a mass to flux ratio. It's usually between 2 and 5, and it varies. So the wind cases were 2 and 4.5 for the whole cloud. For the outflow case, I think I showed you the 1.5 mass to flux ratio. Is that what you were asking? Oh, yeah, I don't know that off the top of my head.
Well, you're reading this context.
What you are
interested in is this mass to flux ratio, because that's what measure how much the magnetic field is resisting to the gravitational collapse.
Okay.
But usually, this translates into large beta.
The magnetic pressure is much stronger than the thermal pressure. But I don't know what those values are for these. One last question.
So you showed that the Vink wind law makes bubbles that are too strong and that break out too strongly. How hard would it be to try some of the very low wind rates that Nathan's been suggesting?
Yeah, I'll probably try that, but I'm a little bit concerned that it won't impact the cloud very much because the mass loss rates are just so low.
It might be interesting to show that, because I don't think anyone's actually done simulations in those new regimes. So.
Yeah, that's probably true.
But if that's the case, then it's a constraint on, you know, either those bubbles aren't really from winds or maybe wind models are wrong.
Yeah, it could be a bit of both. I mean, some of the bubbles are very convincing. They look like shells. There's a source there. It's a B star. But some of them are less, you know, less believable. All right. Thank you.